riding in the car, car, take me riding in the car, car, take you riding in my car, car, I'll take you riding in my car. I'm gonna let you blow the horn, I'm gonna let you blow the horn. Well, I'll take you riding in my car.
Good afternoon. It's Every Other Sunday again, and welcome to Sustainability Now, a biweekly program focused on environment and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Dr. Sherman Lewis, Cal State East Bay Emeritus Professor of Political Science. Are you there, Dr. Lewis?
Yes, I am.
Is it okay if I call you Sherman?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Hold on a sec. Dr. Lewis taught at Cal State East Bay for almost 38 years, retiring in 2004. One of the focuses of his research and activism in recent decades has been urban sustainability, especially around Hayward and Cal State. I've invited him on the show today to talk about Bayview Village, a proposed car-free housing development in Hayward and other subjects related to his work on sustainability. Professor Lewis, Sherman, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Thank you.
So in looking through the various articles about you and the things you've written, I saw that your interest in sustainability dates at least back to the 1990s. And since that's, of course, a topic of interest on the show, I wonder if you could start by telling us something of your life, history, education, specializations, and how you got interested in sustainability.
That's a long question
with
a really long answer.
We can have a conversation about it.
I've been thinking about a few little vignettes that might convey my life experience, which perhaps with nature starts in Logan Canyon, north of Logan on Highway 89, going up to Idaho. And there's just this beautiful little picnic on the Logan River where my mom would take us on some picnics. And it was just a beautiful spot that I remember, along with her commitment to protecting the environment. And then I was doing research in Peru, and I came back in 1967 and discovered that it was actually possible to join the Sierra Club, that I was such an admirer of John Muir that I thought, well, I should do this. And it's always been part of my instincts, so it's hard to identify a specific time. One more thing I remember for Hayward work was back in the 70s when the Association of Bay Area Governments was starting some regional planning. They had a map showing various land uses around the Bay Area. So I looked at Hayward. We have a big undeveloped ridge area called Walpert Ridge. And they showed two circles in the middle of this open space for future development. And I wondered, is that really necessary? So I got involved and thought about it and discovered that I was an urbanist, which I hadn't quite understood before, which the idea is to keep the growth in the city, find a way to live more compactly, more efficiently, with less dependency on the automobile. Ready for next.
You taught at Cal State East Bay for what, 40 years or so, right?
That's about right. Yes.
And but you're in the political science department. You were in the political science department. So, how did you reconcile? And I gather you were Latin Americanist. Is that correct?
I started off as Latin Americanist, and within a year or so, became extremely discouraged. The people in the field had no interest in what I had to say. My students were not signing up for the courses. The demand for my time was really on American public policy and American government. I got interested in public policy. I'd actually always been interested in it, just didn't realize I could make a living teaching about it.
Uh-huh.
And within that area, I gravitated to the environmental issues, California politics, and became active in the Sierra Club because of local issues and regional issues. Advocating for open space and fighting a freeway here in Hayward.
Yeah, can you tell us a bit about the freeway? I saw that that was one of your signal accomplishments.
I'd like to think so, and I'm not claiming it was justified. I didn't answer your previous question honestly completely.
We can come back to it.
It circled back into my teaching, because everything I was learning by doing became part of my teaching for how people can be active in advocating and working for the things that they believe in. So we did get involved in the freeway fight. It was going to be quite destructive coming through Hayward. And initially, my attitude was, you've got the environment that's worth protecting, and you've got housing that needs to be built. So there's a conflict of values, and you need to balance between these conflicting needs. The more I studied it, though, the more I realized I was wrong, that the real problem was the underlying economics that was driving suburbanization, which involved enormous subsidization of the automobile and a failure to consider important economic values relating to the environment, things we call externalities. And if you were to factor these in, you would discover that the existing urban areas are more efficient. If you were to have proper prices, we would have growth within the cities. So it really became a question of the proper pricing and organization of the economy versus subsidization of automobiles. In that context, the freeway was completely unjustified. If they'd have charged a toll for it, they never would have proposed it in the first place. Nobody would pay to ride on it, drive on it.
Of course, that's what's being done now. I mean, it's with the high-volume lanes, right? HOV
yes, exactly.
Lanes, I guess.
And the HOV lanes, to build a new lane, theoretically, to reduce the amount of traffic, simply free up space on the mixed-flow lanes, and more people come in because there's more space in those lanes, and you wind up with a higher level of travel and congestion than you did before.
Yeah, well,
work.
I think that came up on a previous show, you know, what people think when they think that there's more space on the highway. Well,
they're not looking at space, they're looking at travel time. And if the speed gets a little bit faster, they realize they can go a little bit further in the same time and live a little bit further from work and so on.
Okay.
People are making, it's called travel time budget. Everybody has their own budget, and so they make decisions based on that.
Yeah, well, you know, whenever I go anywhere and I look at Google Maps, I think, oh, it's only going to take that long to get there, and it never does. It's always longer. Well, so one of the major challenges to our global future is making the city sustainable. I mean, the generic city. And more than half of humanity now lives in cities, and a lot of those cities are on the coast, and we don't have to get into what that means. But in a broad sense, can cities become sustainable? I know that it's said that they're more sustainable because they're more compact. But, you know, there's a broader question here, of course, which has a lot to do with infrastructure and basic goods getting in. Do you think that's possible?
I have a kind of a question that a little bit precedes that.
Okay, go for it.
Which relates to something that's never thought of as part of urban planning, and it's the topic of the status of women.
Uh-huh.
As we improve the status of women, we find that population growth slows, stabilizes, even can begin to decline.
Yeah.
And the population gets older, generally healthier and more educated. So that a lot of the pressure on the environment comes from a continually growing population. The other side of that is the technology we're using. But I think cities can be sustainable if we find ways to moderate our population growth, change our technologies to be more sustainable. Then certainly the city can work, and we're discovering that in the area of energy, in the area of transportation with the explosion of electric cars, with a lot of younger people preferring to live in cities without cars and showing that it's a high-quality lifestyle. I've done a lot of research on old neighborhoods that were built to high standards, and people want to live there so much that the rents are high.
Are there any particular cities that you point to as exemplars?
Well, one of my favorites is Back Bay in Boston.
Uh-huh.
But there's about 30 neighborhoods in Boston. I just finished an article delineating neighborhoods in Boston based on walking distances. I also have a paper published recently on San Francisco neighborhoods. There's about 86 of these neighborhoods that can be defined, of which a dozen or so achieve the sufficient density within a walking distance to have very low automobile use and a lot of mobility without owning a car.
Well, I lived in Boston, well, near Boston for about 5 years. I don't remember exactly. Where is Back Bay? Is that where?
Well, the Charles River loops around
Boston.
Yeah,
yeah.
And old Boston was on some dry, high land up Beacon Hill and all of that.
Right.
And the Charles River had a huge bay behind Boston, which is Back Bay.
Uh-huh.
So it's south of Cambridge. And when they built the railroad into Boston, they used the railroad to bring enormous amounts of dirt in to fill in Back Bay. And they knew Boston was going to grow, and they had all this new land, and they had an extremely well-designed layout for the streets and the buildings that achieved a very high density, and it's a wonderful neighborhood.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll just say the obvious, that, of course, it was built before the car. So,
yes.
So you know,
we can't afford to live there.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to Bayview Village, because I know that that's been a project of yours for quite some time. Can you tell us something about that and about the site?
I was doing some research on the freeway, about a 5.25-mile distance, walking it property by property to make an estimate of how much housing could be built on the land that would become available if the freeway were stopped. Turned out to be over 300 units. But coming along the way, I came across this old quarry, about 30 acres, of which about 19 acres were developable. Now, I'd written an article a few years before that for Urban Land magazine on an abstract pedestrian neighborhood concept of 100 acres. But I thought, well, here's a place where you could actually build something. It was lost in time because it was tied up for this freeway that never got happened. It was just sitting there for a future that could be a walkable neighborhood. So I began to design it and advocate it about 15 years ago.
Oh,
and
okay.
I'm still working on it, and I'm still $22 million short.
Listen, I need to take a short break, and then we'll come back and talk more about Bayview Village, okay? You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org on the Internet. Tune in to KSQD Tuesday mornings at 7 for Climate One, produced by the Commonwealth Club. I have to listen to it every Tuesday morning, folks, and it's well worth the time. Climate One is a forum for candid discussion among climate scientists, policymakers, activists, and concerned citizens, with a focus on energy, the economy, and the environment. Climate One airs Tuesday mornings at 7 a.m. and alternate Mondays at 6 p.m. here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. So you're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest this week, or this bi-week, is Professor Sherman Lewis, a retired professor of political science at Cal State East Bay in Hayward. And we're talking about urban sustainability, and in particular about Bayview Village, a project that Professor Lewis started 15 years ago and is still working on. So let's go on and talk a little bit more about that. So you need $22 million. I thought I saw something in the Chronicle a few weeks ago. That's how I found you, about the possibility of something actually happening there.
The article was opening of publicity of awareness.
Uh-huh.
But it didn't really contain enough of the important information that would make it clear why it would be interesting to an investor. So I've been sending some commentary pieces to the Chronicle in hopes that they would publish my 800-word commentary. I've sent them 5 versions so far, and every week or so I will send them another commentary in hopes that they will give me some ink.
Yeah. Tell me, how many units do you think would go in there?
We can have about 700 units in three-story row housing on walking streets.
Okay.
From studios to five bedrooms. And for all household sizes, all of these units are affordable to median income households under HUD rules because we separate the cost of parking and the cost of energy and pursue many efficiencies of construction.
Where do you put the cars?
We will have 100 spaces for cars in a specific parking area, but it's a bit of a walk from the first 100 houses. And then we have 600 more houses or units after that, and there clearly will not be enough parking. So we will have a lot. We will have a range for off-site parking, which most people won't use because the project owns its own little bus system, which provides frequent high-speed transit up to the campus and down the hill to Hayward downtown and the BART station. We have a lot of other ideas for guaranteed ride home, for vouchers for health care, arrangements with Lyft and similar rideshare, car share, car rental. And also, we're not selling to people who can't live there conveniently. If you need a car to get to work every day, you should not come into this project. But to clearly, people who go to Cal State, involved with Cal State, it's just a, you know, it's a short walk up the hill, short ride up the hill. People who use BART are working downtown. They'll be downtown in 6 minutes. People who are retired, like me, I want to live there. And people who have a home occupation. All those people don't need routine use of a car every day.
Okay. And $22 million is what you need for the site development?
No, I need about $18.5 million to buy the property. I need a couple million for entitlement and specifications. And I will need loans for site improvements. The building loans won't be a big problem. That's just a rough estimate. I have a detailed pro forma that explains all of that in enormous detail. It was a real education in learning how pro formas work. I've had to deal with is people don't believe it'll work. And so I said, okay, maybe it won't work. So what do we do? Well, what I've done is I've come up with something called risk reduction. Risk reduction means a way of changing the plan if people don't buy it. The first thing is to allow people to pay for reservations. They have to give you some money if they want to be sure to get a house there. And if we don't get enough reservations within a given time for the 100-unit first phase, then we would go back to a car-oriented project. Okay, now we start building, and we've got 100 units, and we've got 100 parking spaces, and we're having some problems selling units because of the parking. We have something called de-parking incentives for people to give up the renting a spot on the site. But if that's not working, we do have some room for expanding the parking. Now we go along a little bit more. If we don't hit our target sales within 2 years, the whole project reverts to a car-oriented project, and we have a site plan that allows the conversion at that time. So if an investor needs to reduce risk, that pretty much would give them three different ways of bailing out if they couldn't hit their targets.
Two things. The first is a comment. I was going to say, well, have you tried to approach any of the the big tech companies on the peninsula, but then I realized you wouldn't actually want those people since they'd have to drive across the bay, wouldn't they? It's kind of hard to get across the bay.
To the extent that they want to invest in housing, this would be a good investment.
Well, no, sure.
And we have been asking them for money. We, for the last few weeks, we send a letter to the CEOs of five big local corporations that claim that they care about housing, along with, they get the same editorial we're sending to the Chronicle. But just like the Chronicle, they don't return our calls and don't answer our email. So we're in the phase now where two developers have submitted proposals to the city for the quarry. And in a few days, we'll find out what those proposals are, but they probably are not very promising because none of the developers responded to the brochure that I sent them during the RFP request for proposal process the city is conducting.
That's too bad. Tell me, were you inspired by Freiburg?
Not really.
Maybe it is tremendously educational,
but the problem is that Freiburg hasn't really been all that successful throughout Europe. It seems to be a great project and very much along the lines that I am advocating.
Maybe you can say a few words about what Freiburg is.
Freiburg is the name of a city, but the name of the development within Freiburg has a different name, the car-free area within Freiburg.
Yeah.
And it was an old base, and they built it to be car-free. And they have parking on the side, enough parking for everybody, a very advanced energy and a lot of walking. The thing that appealed to me about Freiburg was the tremendous number of kids, the families that live there. It's a very, very kid-friendly. And I want to make sure that Bayview also has that family appeal. Should appeal to everybody, all ages.
But it's the fact that there are no cars zooming up and down the street, I guess. Freiburg is a city in Germany, by the way, folks. We never did mention that, which is probably an important point. One of the things that I read was an article about how much space we actually devote to cars in cities, which is a considerable amount if you just go out your door and look. But can you tell us something about that? And what?
I can't remember all the numbers, but I got curious about that because if you have wide streets and parking, you have less space for the houses. So you can increase the number of houses by getting rid of the width you need for the street. So I compared Bayview with a car-oriented project with streets of a certain size with enough parking and so on, and I came up with some estimates for that. Then I also said or looked at what happens if you put parking underneath. And so I have a design CAD program, and there's a website that allows estimating housing costs. And I came up with a pretty good estimate of how much savings you could have if you went car-free. And I think the rough reduction of cost was about 40%.
Wow. And what would you do with the space? Would you build in the space, or would that be, you know, open space for other purposes? I mean, imagine that. You know?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah,
the 18.5-acre area has a certain amount of area for parks based on city open space requirements.
Mm-hmm.
So that stayed constant between the two research scenarios. So people have, in fact, that became an interesting question because one of the city's ideas was to have a central park. But the result was that a lot of people were some walking distance from this central park. I had started off and continue to have little parks scattered through the area. So just a little distance outside your door, you'll reach a nice little park with some picnic tables and so on, along with a village square, which is where the busway comes through and where the community center is and the cafe and things like that.
I've talked a little bit about this in some of my classes about doing other things with streets, and I know there have been some projects and sometimes kind of pop-up projects to try and close down streets and set up cafes and things like that. But I always thought it'd be interesting if you could dig them up and start gardens, you know, food,
yes.
Grow food. Do you know of anything like that?
No, but it reminds me of something I've thought about relating to charging for parking.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of San Francisco has a market-based charge for parking, but they don't necessarily have an economic-based charge for parking, which reflect the real value of the parking space. And it's possible the economic cost of that space would be so high, nobody would park there. So then you could plant some grass and a tree.
Yeah.
I don't know how far I go with that idea, but it's intriguing.
It is.
Especially if you had some notion that this just needs some grass and a tree. You just go and do it. That's basically what they do in Europe. They plan what they want. They tell the developers this is what's going to happen, and that's what happens.
Oh, they don't do it as guerrilla tactics then, huh?
Well, another thing I've realized is that car-free is a nice idea, but it probably overemphasizes the amount of no cars, because my research indicates that even with relatively car-free development, we're going to need about 15 to 20% of our trips by car, just in the nature of the kinds of trips that they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the thing to look for is car ownership in these denser neighborhoods, because they get rid of the private car and start using public cars. A public car is the idea or a phrase for car share, car rental, shared ride, and taxis.
Mm-hmm.
And then that becomes the way people get around.
Well,
when they need a private car.
So that leads to this, it doesn't exactly lead to the dilemma, but I know that in San Francisco they've studied the use of so-called car sharing, and discovered that Uber and Lyft are actually contributing to street congestion a considerable amount because people go cruising around. So how would you organize a public car system so that you wouldn't have that happening, you know, people cruising around looking for rides or customers?
There seems to be two things that are going on. One of them is a private car cruising for a parking spot.
Right.
Professor Donald Shoup has shown that there's a considerable amount of congestion caused by that problem, and it is solved by charging the market rate for parking so that 20% of your spaces are, on average, available for somebody to park in.
Mm-hmm.
Then your cruising for parking disappears. The Lyft-Uber problem is a bit of a surprise because it turns out that there's space on the street for these things where they're slowing down traffic because of their congestion they're creating, but the travel time is still acceptable for people's travel time budgets. So there's a real economic conundrum that I'm not quite sure how to solve. San Francisco has gotten the private cars off of Market Street, and that seems to be working pretty well, with the somewhat predictable result that on Mission Street, the traffic has not increased very much. And that's what we found. When you reduce capacity, you don't divert traffic, you actually reduce traffic.
I have an anecdote about this, but we're going to take a station break right now. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org on the internet.
Imagine you're standing on the wharf in Santa Cruz. You look down over the edge, and this is what you hear. Been listening to Sea Lions at the Wharf, just some of our Santa Cruz critters at K-Squid 90.7 FM Community Radio.
Okay, hi, you're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, your host, and I'm speaking with Professor Sherman Lewis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Cal State East Bay. We're talking about cars and cities and sustainability and parking and things like that. I was going to just tell a story that one of the phenomena here up at UCSC is that students are using Uber and Lyft to get around campus. They don't want to wait for our buses. And so it's not clear, but we have traffic jams at certain times of the day. It's hard to imagine. And it's entirely obvious why we have traffic jams, but there's a little data point. But going back to Bayview for a moment, what would you charge people for a parking space? I'm sort of curious, what's the market value of a parking space in that development?
We don't know yet, but we're going to start off with $125 to $150 a month for a parking space.
Uh-huh.
And then if the demand goes up at a quarterly auction, then the price goes up, or it could come down. And of course, with more people living there, the demand is likely to go up.
So you'd sell
then.
You'd rent them by auction.
It becomes so expensive that people won't buy a house there.
Yeah.
Yes. Dutch auction.
Yeah. I mean, I seem to recall that in Freiburg, there's this, like, a fixed annual fee, but maybe I'm thinking of something else.
No, they have plenty of parking at Freiburg. They charge for it anyway.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's just off on one side. So we won't have the kind of supply that they have in Freiburg.
So,
I might mention that the way you solve a congestion problem is with a congestion fee, like I-15 going down to San Diego. And
yeah.
It's a dynamic toll, and so if your Uber people on the campus are causing a congestion problem, you charge them for going through that area, and then you make sure the bus can go around it for free. That speeds up the bus and slows down the Ubers and makes them pay their own way.
You know, I just can't imagine them doing that. But okay, that's a good idea.
Technology allows us to do amazing things.
Well, okay, let's go on with that. Congestion pricing is actually an interesting topic, and I know it keeps coming up with New York, and I think it's come up with San Francisco, and I know that London uses congestion pricing to keep people out of the core. But do you think anything like that is going to happen in the United States?
New York has come so close.
Yeah,
more
I
than
know.
Once. You keep hoping that it'll happen. It's fairly easy to make it in San Francisco, but the underlying cultural problem is that people do not think rationally about traffic. And as long as we have a culture of subsidizing cars, then people continue to suffer from what they love. We can solve the problem fairly easily with economics, but it's hard to get it implemented.
Well, tell me a little more about the economics. Are you talking now about congestion charges? Are you talking about per mile taxes? You know, when you talk about economics and transportation, let's say a little bit more about what you envision.
Any price that costs the user in a rational way can increase or decrease their use. Parking charges are very similar to congestion charges because you basically are dealing with the overall trip, whether it's a congestion entry-level fee or whether it's a per-mile fee or a parking fee. They all add up to have the cost of driving a car reflect its underlying real economic cost. In San Diego, the dynamic charge goes up and down from a fairly small cost below a dollar to over $4, depending on the time of day.
Right.
And so the traffic, once they're on that stretch, can drive along at a pretty high speed, and that includes the buses. And the bus costs are paid for by the congestion fee. So people who are priced off the road now have a faster, cheaper ride into the city. People who really want to go over on the mixed flow lanes then can go there and get a slower ride. But their ride is not as slow as it would be if they did not have the congestion toll stretch of highway. So the equities all work out if you understand how it all works.
Well, it seems to me that one catch in your formula there was when you used the term rationality. Since it's become clear that people are not necessarily rational in an economic sense, even in an economic sense, you know, political sense, that's completely out the window. But, you know, and I think people buy cars according to fashion and style and their desires and fantasies, right? Whereas really, you don't need anything particularly fancy or with bells and whistles to get around. So, I mean, that seems like a great example of irrationality in transportation.
Well, oddly enough, the buying and selling of automobiles reflects something pretty close to a real marketplace that reflects the cost of the cars producing them and all the other costs involved. The automobile system is a mix of markets and subsidies. And I think the biggest problem is the huge subsidies involved that lower the overall cost so that people are still buying cars instead of the alternatives.
But whenever anybody proposes something like that, right, there's this enormous screaming that goes up. You're violating people's freedom to go wherever they want, you know, all kinds of things like that. One of my questions is, can you think of ways to get people out of their cars? I mean, it's one thing to talk abstractly about, you know, if we raise prices, we shift time of demand. We shift various kinds of incentives. But it seems to me that our love affair with the car, by the way, I don't love my car, but our love affair with the car, you know, as a country, is something that's so deeply embedded in our psyche that it's hard to see how to get around that.
I think we need to have a transition from ignorance to perception of subsidy as a crime. And we did that with pollution. We got to the point with smog where we realized that the health costs were so horrendous that we passed the Clean Air Act. And with more fuel-efficient cars and with catalytic converters, we've made amazing progress in reducing smog. If you look at the BART system here in the Bay Area, we used to have free parking. Everybody thought people ride BART because of free parking. I was on the BART board for 4 years. Every chance I got, I talk about charging for parking. At one point, one of the directors was so annoyed, she wanted a motion passed to stop me from talking about charging for parking. A few years after I left the board, there was such a financial crisis that BART started charging for parking. And now we have charging for parking for BART all over the place, and we still have very high ridership for BART. Nobody sees the parking charges as a problem. BART has other problems of fare jumping and homelessness and bad behavior on BART, but certainly not the cost of parking.
Well,
and so now the parking is available for people who want to pay for it, and other people still find a way to get to BART.
Yeah, well, I'm not arguing against, you know, these proposals. It's that sort of political jump. Well, I mean, you're a political scientist, right? I teach politics. I always tell people, you know, the hardest thing to do to get done whenever you have a proposal is what I think of as the politics, right? The technology is simple. The economics are pretty simple too. It's getting over the politics, yeah. And that's where, you know, the headwinds are pretty severe.
Well, we're dealing with cultural change, and often the political decisions come at the tail end of cultural change. Cultural change is induced by having a problem that people want to deal with, by having advocates who see a solution, by gradual education of the public. Professor Don Shoup has been analyzing parking for decades. He's written a book, The High Cost of Free Parking. Almost all policy people know that that is the solution, but it's been extremely slow to get implemented. It is happening, but it's a problem of cultural change, and it's pretty obvious that it needs to be done. And I have a lot of frustration, along with everybody else who does this advocacy, that it's just so hard to get to a real result.
Where would you start?
Many places it's already started.
No, that's not quite what I mean. I mean, let's say, you know, on the one hand, you know, it would be great to have a national policy or even a statewide policy.
Definitely not a national policy. No way.
A statewide, right?
We're going to do this little bits. We're going to do this little bits of policy and little bits of places, do a little bit here, a little bit there.
Okay.
Parking here, congestion there, regulation over here. People showing that something else works, other people thinking that's a good idea. It's complex beyond belief because we have a economy that is and a society that's just enormous, hundreds of millions of people. So you cannot do anything very quickly.
Yeah.
Global climate change is going to be important because as more and more people realize that we have to have climate change and as more teenagers are successful in annoying a U.S. president, the more progress we can possibly make because there's more and more elections where more and more candidates support more and more work on global warming, and we're going to see things come along already for energy, the sale of electric cars, all this stuff. There are trends in energy, in primary energy, and transportation energy. Enormous amount of attention and advocacy is going into this, advocacy groups, the research, the universities. The size of the problem is enormous, but the response is also enormous, and it's gradually having an impact.
You think it can have an impact in time?
I don't know yet.
Yeah.
I think humanity is designed to destroy itself, and we're in a big, long process of a few hundred years before we're going to know how it comes out.
Oh, well. I guess we'll just have to dream about it. I want to pose a hypothetical. Let's pretend you've been appointed the Greater Bay Area car czar, and your word is law. So, you know, you could wait. This is the way our president works, right? He thinks if you say something, it happens. But what would you do to address regional transportation? I mean, what sorts of things would you want to put in place for the Bay Area?
Where there is excessive demand for parking and it's not being charged for, mm-hmm. I would charge for it.
Mm-hmm.
Where anybody parks a car on a property they don't own, they would pay for the rental separately from the payment of the unit or the business that they're operating. So you would have something called a cash out for people going to work. They could receive money or park their car at work. If they take the money, they don't get to park their car at work. So with unbundling of rentals, with cash out, with parking charges based on market rates, you've done an enormous amount to increase that part of the question. On long stretches of the freeway, I would put in congestion charges.
Mm-hmm.
It would be electronically collected without slowing the traffic down very much.
Mm-hmm.
If we have Bay Bridge charged for $4, $5 to cross the bridge, and it's not high enough, then it goes to $6. We put the money into making BART. We put the money into building better rail. We look at not building any more highways. That stops. We do some nice pavement maintenance, but we don't build any new capacity. And through these various economic charges, we make some progress. We facilitate the development of walking-oriented housing like Bayview. San Francisco, Berkeley, Oakland core areas have a lot of walking-oriented people who don't own a car and don't need one, or have a car but use it very little. And so through a whole variety of economic measures, all of which I can't remember at the moment, I would implement until we make some progress. And if people protested too much, I would back off and go someplace else and then come back and charge at it again and try to make it happen here and there with lots of policies all over the place that add up to making the car pay its own way and make the city more livable and more sustainable and more affordable.
Okay, well, I mean, that sounds like a great program. So I'll appoint you the car czar, okay? So let's shift a little bit. You sent me a copy of your book, Creation Care for Neighborhoods, which is significantly about Bayview Village. But I'm sort of interested in the more general proposition of creation care for neighborhoods. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I like the phrase. Now,
it's a great phrase.
Religious organizations, churches, and progressive religious people came up with it. And unfortunately, it's gotten attached to religious beliefs in a narrow sense.
Mm.
But I think the phrase reflects a broader feelings we have that we should care for creation. And the way our cities work now, our neighborhoods, we're destroying that creation. It's not sustainable. It's causing enormous problems of the loss of nature, and it's wrong. If we're going to care for creation, we need to do a better job of managing our neighborhoods and a whole series of many related policies.
Yeah, I looked up, you mentioned this organization, California Interfaith Power and Light, which I really like the name, even though I am a hardcore atheist. But creation care strikes me as a kind of a fairly broad notion, and you're applying it to neighborhoods, which I like very much because it doesn't involve any kind of a theological commitment, really. So,
that's true, but I would beware of your atheism going too far, because it's pretty clear that God is a creation of human culture and exists within the human mind.
Okay,
it is real in the mind.
Well, we won't pursue that one. All right,
we don't need to.
You also sent me this chapter, The Crisis of the Anthropocene, and I was wondering whether that's a standalone chapter article or is it part of a book.
It's one of three long articles I've written. I felt that my own thinking was getting confused and disorganized on all of these threats to nature. So I wrote an article about all of these things, trying to summarize what all the scholars had been finding. And I tried to make it as negative as possible. Instead of focusing on anything hopeful, I listed all of the problems. And by being so negative about so many different things, I began to feel better because I understood it better. Climate change, obviously, is one of the big ones. Pollution and various kinds of chemicals we have. The population issues. There's a half a dozen to a dozen major topics, all of which interrelate to each other in terms of how the success of human culture is destroying itself and the rest of nature. And we really need to be aware of it in order to do something about it.
Okay, take a break. I'll be right back with you, okay? You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org on the internet. The second and fourth Sundays of the month, KSQD presents Faith Matters, hosted by Seth Shapiro. Faith Matters is an interfaith discussion with leaders from a variety of religious and spiritual traditions. The discussion is wide-ranging and respectful, and call-ins are welcome. Tune in to Faith Matters this Sunday evening at 6, KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. And I've also been asked to announce that Extinction Rebellion, remember those folks were on the show a few weeks ago, is holding a panel on Friday, March 20th, this year, called What Now? A Community Response to the Climate Crisis. And amongst the people appearing on this panel are our local Jonathan Franzen, as well as Gary Patton. That's Friday, March 20th, 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the Inner Light Ministries at 5630 Soquel Drive. Well, you're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD 90.7 FM. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, and I'm speaking this afternoon. Time has changed, and it's now still sunny. With Professor Sherman Lewis of Cal State East Bay, we're talking about urban topics, especially as they apply to sustainability. So let's get back to that. I mean, can you summarize your view of the crisis of the Anthropocene, or how you think about this in sort of broad terms?
I think one thing I'm struggling with is the nature of human culture. Mm-hmm. We don't really live as individual separate beings. We absorb a culture during our socialization as we grow up. We learn a language. We absorb values and ideas. We participate in society, which has enormous influence. Over time, we choose occupations. We choose what we will be active doing. We have a way of thinking that comes out of many centuries of evolution of the human genome and the physiology. And on top of that, the brain sustains a culture which is evolving faster than the underlying genome. But that physiology and that culture are not necessarily oriented towards survival, not necessarily oriented towards the kind of values that some of us have. And it's not clear if our underlying human nature has the ability to learn enough, fast enough, and to adopt the critical values that we need to have for a worthwhile living. One value, I think, is science. Using science as the primary way that we understand the nature of the created world that we live in. And the other value is empathy. Living in a way where we gain satisfaction ourselves from the happiness of others. Where we understand how other people are feeling. We don't try to manipulate them. In some cases, we understand a person well enough that we should probably shoot them before they shoot us, because defense is part of that. But for the most part, I think people want to relate, want to have opportunity, want to be appreciated, want to be liked. And by having artificial conflicts, we are causing a lot of cultural conflicts, military, a lot of violence, because we learned to not have empathy, learned to conflict with each other over crises that develop over time and have a great deal of cultural support and are very, very difficult to stop. You can only have so much compassion for how many millions of refugees are coming into your country before you say, no, we can't just handle anymore. We're already costing us too much, and we just can't do it. And you stop people at the border, and those people are fleeing conflict, trying to save their lives because we haven't figured out how to deal with ethnic and political conflicts. And we're going to have to do that. We're going to have to come to bear to understand how cultural change and population growth are creating these conflicts that reflect these underlying causes. And I'm just not sure that we have the ability, as we are from what nature has produced, to do that. It's ambiguous.
Well,
but we have to,
No, go ahead.
Well, I think that we have a lot of people out there who are doing the right thing and are organizing and advocating the things that need to be done. They're not always pragmatic, but by and large, there's a lot of good stuff out there to try to balance the bad, and we really need to develop better these networks of people who have professional understandings and can work together in networks to develop institutional solutions. Now, certainly, the advanced countries, and I do not include the United States on that list, but the advanced countries of Western Europe, Canada, Japan, Australia, are all doing far better than the United States and are actually leading the way in showing us how to deal with many of these crises of the, many of these problems of the crisis of the Anthropocene.
Well, I was going to, what I was going to intervene and say was that, of course, our leaders tend to cultivate fear in us. And of course, that's a very primal emotion and reaction. And it's much easier to manipulate fear than to cultivate empathy.
I disagree.
Okay, so tell me.
Some leaders are horrible and other leaders are pretty good. And we need to call out those who are divisive, and we need to reward those who are trying to get us all to work together. We choose our leaders through a semi-democratic process, which is what we have to live with until we figure out how to make this country more of a democracy.
Well, let's get off the, and then into politics for a moment, okay? I maybe you're correct about, you know, leaders differ in terms of that. But on the other hand, well, you and I both know that the Cold War was particular time when fear was cultivated daily.
And somehow Reagan and Gorbachev got together and signed a strategic arms limitation agreement that stabilized the arms race.
Well,
I would have expected Gorbachev to do that. Reagan kind of surprised me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, all right. So it's a good point.
We're re-escalating the arms race because of the degradation of American politics.
Yeah.
And people are extremely alarmed over this, but it's a very small number of people who are knowledgeable about these issues. That was another factor in the crisis of the Anthropocene.
Oop. Did we lose them? Are you there?
Yep.
Oh, okay. I thought we had lost you. Well, listen, what is your sort of overall assessment then of our present and future environmental politics and policy? I mean, so you were mentioning you wrote the Anthropocene piece to kind of lay out all of the awful things.
Yeah.
And
I wrote another piece called Our First 1,000 Years of Thinking.
Yeah.
And that goes back 500 years with the scientific revolution that was started by some key people, like Francis Bacon is the one who was the first important thinker to lay out science as a system. Even though others were doing science, he understood it in the broadest context. And we have been trying to get away from anti-scientific thinking ever since. And what I realized is that that aspect of the Enlightenment really hasn't gone very far. We had this idea that, okay, now we have science, but we don't. Not enough people really have a grasp of science and scientific thinking, and that's a major reason for the problems we're having. We'd be well on our way to dealing with global warming if we had a much wider understanding of science.
Tell me something about how that would work.
Well, I think it happens slowly through education and by people who have learned in usually in high school or college how to think scientifically, realize that what scientists are saying in general is our best understanding, even though it continues to evolve. And we find that among people who do not have a high school education, that they are less, much more opposed. They don't believe the science, and they support authoritarian leaders.
And I was just going to say that you know, some people would like to be told what to do. It's much easier than, you know, having to make your own decisions.
Well, I have a neighbor who loves to do native gardening.
Uh-huh.
And I have a lot of native gardening that needs to be done, and she loves it so much she's been doing it for free. So I'm quite willing to have her tell me what to do. So I think the problem is not that we need leaders. We just need to be careful about the leaders we pick. We're not going to have a system without leaders. We have to choose them better, and we ourselves try to be leaders. I tried to be a leader in my classroom, and I'm sure you do also. You want our students to learn and think. One thing we know is it's really hard to tell students what to think. They just won't do it. They tend to learn on their own in their own way, and we try to take advantage of whatever they're willing to learn from us.
And when you say that, you mean that they don't learn to think, or they don't listen to us?
They may learn to think, and they may listen to us, but they're doing it on their own.
Oh, okay.
They're very much on individuals, and the more we can relate to that, the more we can communicate with them and maybe help them grow.
Well, all right. Anything else? We're almost out of time, so anything else you want to add to our conversation?
My address, email, is sherman@csuhayward.us.
Okay, go ahead.
You want to email me? I can send you more things than you probably want to read.
Yeah, and I can say that I did spend a little time surfing the web the last week or so, and I found quite a lot of stuff that you had written. So there's a rich vein of materials to be mined out there, folks. Okay, well, listen, thank you so much for being on Sustainability Now. I hope we can keep in touch, because a lot of the work you're doing is of great interest to me as well. All right.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Okay. 2 weeks from today, my guest is tentatively UCSC Professor Steve McKay, who is co-director of No Place Like Home, which is a project at the university that focuses on affordable housing in Santa Cruz and what we can do about to make housing more affordable. It's a particularly timely topic in light of the fact that much of the underlying issues behind the graduate student strike, the TA strike at UCSC, has to do with affordable housing. And so I hope that we won't only talk about, you know, how high the rent is, but also what we can do about it. So join me on Sunday, March 22nd at 5 to 6 p.m. right here on KSQD 90.7 FM on your dial or ksqd.org. And by the way, the station is rebroadcasting Sunday shows in this time slot on Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m. for all of you who can't sleep past 6 o'clock. And if you've missed program broadcasts, you can find the archive shows at tinyurl.com/RESD6JB. And you can write me at ronniel@ksqd.org. So until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
Take me riding in the car, take me riding in the car, take you riding in my car, I'll take you riding in my car. I'm gonna let you blow the horn, I'm gonna let you blow the horn.
You've been listening to Sustainability Now with Ronnie Lipschitz on KSQD Santa Cruz.